Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. You hang up being there. But 51% of your prisoners will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. And I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control buildings and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money from the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police departments. Then the fourth floor that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, what? Who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
Like, you just see
$600,000 deducted.
It. Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." "Oh, man." He said, "This woman found your taxes in your accountant's office on the floor." Every check I had written and every was stapled together for 7 years, quarterly taxes, all of it. So he said, man, that's tax evasion. You can go to prison. And I said, what are we going to do? So he said, hold on, man, let me get some lawyers. So he called up some tax accountants out of Chicago. These boys was the best. And they set me down and they said, man, we got a major problem. He said, I got a friend working at the IRS. Let me take the first year. We took the first year and we sent it in. And he said, man, well, this is an old tax return. He said, man, we got a problem. He got more, but he didn't know it. And so we need a tax payment plan. So the tax payment plan was so astronomical that it was no way I could pay this. So the deal was, if you miss one payment, we come and seize all your assets and you go into jail. That was the deal. So the way I found out I was in real bad trouble was my accountants, my former manager, lawyer, got on a conference call to discuss it. But they sent out an email with the conference call number to my assistant. But it wasn't supposed to go to me. She inadvertently gave it to me. I wasn't even supposed to be on the call. So when I logged in, they were already talking, and I just didn't announce myself. And I heard them say, nobody can live under this amount of stress. There's no way he can pay the back taxes, pay his current taxes, and his living expenses. And I heard a guy on the phone say, what are we going to do when he goes to jail? And I hung the phone up. I went upstairs. I said, Marjorie, Dawson, Marjorie, we got a problem. When I explained it to her, Marjorie started crying. She sat down and cried. My wife cried for 2 straight days. She said, Steve, what you going to do? I said, I'm going to go to work. I took every comedy gig in this country. I signed every contract. I went to work, man. I worked every single Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I went to every venue, the Verizon, Staples Center, MCI, Phillips. I sold out the Fox. I went everywhere. I stayed on the radio, man. I'm coming, sold out. I never missed a payment. And for 4 years in a row, I was sending $650,000 a month to the government. Plus, I had to pay my current taxes.
New taxes.
I couldn't get behind on nothing. And I was living. So I was credit cards, running them up, paying them off. And finally, man, in 2012, I sold 49% of my radio company to iHeart. I got a check, man. I got me a check. And then, so I paid the government completely off to zero. And that was the first time, man, I could breathe. And then the pay-per-view, I said, let me get out of stand-up, because my wife said, Steve, you finna be a major TV star. You're going to have to stop telling the jokes you're telling, because you're going to ruin your career. Because she saw the political correctness turning. And so she said, Steve, you can stop if you want to. I said, baby, I can't ever stop telling jokes. It's who I am. She said, well, okay, but you got to watch what you say. And all of my TV shows are sponsor-driven. The radio is sponsorship-driven. I said, man, let me get out of this, because I need time to go do more TV. And so I did one last comedy show, but I did it on pay-per-view. And little did I know, for $8, you could watch my last show. I had no idea how many people was going to tune in for that. I made a lot of money. It was the biggest single paycheck I ever made. And next thing you know, I was back. Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, and he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And Master Ronnie saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And in the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she's been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad, Cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
He is going to be locked up for a very long time. Today, the man who admitted to killing a teenager over a pair of Air Jordans learned his fate in court. And it tops our news at 5:30. The judge told 20-year-old Dante Ford that he lacked a moral compass just before sentencing to 28 to 50 years in prison.
Ford pleaded guilty to second-degree murder in the shooting death of 17-year-old Corey Harris Thomas back in June during what was supposed to be a sale of a pair of Air Jordans. Priya Mann following the story. Priya, the victim's parents were in the courtroom, I understand.
And Karen spoke at length. Corey's parents spoke about everything they did to try to prevent their son from living this lifestyle of making a quick buck. He was enrolled in a lot of sports. He went to school in the Grosse Pointe area. But in the end, he lost his life over a pair of expensive gym shoes.
It's not a day I wish I couldn't hold on and tell my loved
one. The parents of Corey Harris Thomas spoke about their devastating loss.
And not being able to open the door and tell him to get up so he can go to school, it breaks my heart.
That was my personal. We did a lot together.
In June, the 17-year-old was shot and killed on the west side over a pair of Air Jordans. Prosecutors say 20-year-old Dante Tyrell Ford met up with the teen and his friend to buy the shoes. During the exchange, the friend and Ford pulled out weapons, and the teen was killed.
Mr. Ford took the life of someone almost the same age, and over what? A pair of Air Jordan Nikes.
Ford declined to speak at his sentencing. The victim's parents say they tried everything to prevent their son from being a victim of violence.
I thought that taking him to a suburb would avoid a situation like this because it happened to so many young men.
And Mr. Ford knew that what he was doing was wrong. He had no right at gunpoint to rob and then eventually kill someone over a pair of gym shoes.
And Ford will spend 28 to 50 years in prison. Corey's parents say they really regret allowing him to stay home from school that day. They were having a new air conditioning unit installed. Corey offered to help his dad put that air conditioning unit in their home. He would later go for this ride with his friend and Ford and never made it home. Reporting live from Frank Murphy Hall of Justice, I'm Priya Mann, Local 4.
Such a very sad story. All right, thank you, Priya.
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now, I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively. And you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the client. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working, and then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tonnes of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technician, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
The Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better, and so I get more customers.
Okay. Jump off title today, communities with no house payment and utility bills. This is what we're launching. This is all part of our crawl, walk, and run era that we're going through. But, yeah, communities, because we've been playing this, so we've got some land. We got enough to start. So communities with I feel a lot of people would like to move to these type of communities. Communities where they're, you don't have to worry about a house payment. Now you got to help build the house. But communities where once a house is built and you help build the house, there are no house payments. There are there are no outside utility bills. It's not coming from a local utility company or municipal utility company. Because the cook, or if you have a cold night or no cold snap, you're going to need some heat, but you can use biofuels for that. So that's all considered. But that we wouldn't consider that a utility bill. Okay, so we're open to any topic, 619-768-2945. That's the number to call. And particularly if you're interested in communities with no house or helping us build, these are like little micro communities with no house payments and no utility bills.
Well, you're about to discover, maybe for the first time in your life, that wealth is not money, and money's not wealth. Real estate's not wealth either. Neither is gold or silver. What is wealth? I believe that wealth is one thing. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. That's what wealth is. Wealth is the value that you create for someone other than you. And so the more we develop our ability to create value for other people, the more wealthy we are. And the reason I say money's not wealth, think about it like this. If you were stuck on a desert island and you had hundreds of millions of dollars in cash, what would it be worth? Nothing. Right? If you're stranded there, nobody knows you're there, nobody can find you, all that money doesn't do you any good. If you're there with another person and they have food and you have water and they have no water and you have no food, then your water becomes your wealth because you can trade them some of your water for some of your food. Are y'all tracking? And so everything that we desire, we get by giving somebody else something they desire. The more value we create for other people, the more wealth we have. It's just that simple. Now, money is one of the stores of value. That's what money is. Money is a store of value, and it's also a way to transfer value. It's also a way to represent value that you've already created, right? So if you think about money as like a certification, right? Like it's a certificate that proves that you've created value for someone other than yourself. Right? And so, like, if you go to Eddie V's, and you're a nice person, right? and you say, well, I would like for y'all to serve me some food. They are going to say, okay, we'll serve you some food, but at the end, they expect you to produce proof that you serve somebody other than you. And that proof shows up in the way of money, right? Because that's all money does. Money shows people that you deserve to have somebody create value for you because you can prove you created value for someone else, right? And here's what's really cool. All of us are good at different things. So we all have different value that we can create for other people. And if we keep the value that we create to ourselves, it doesn't really do us that much good. But if we spread the value, the value that we create for other people, if we spread that around, then it becomes more valuable. Now, here's what's really interesting. I can't create value for someone until I know what's valuable to that someone. So wealth creation has like a lot to do with discovery, like discovering what other people value. And if I'm going to know what other people value, then I got to know where do those values come from? Like, where do values come from? There are things you value that I don't value. There are things I value that you don't value, right? And there are things that we both value, but you might value more than me or I might value more than you. Huh. So where do our values come from? Okay, I believe the first place that values come from is past, perceived, I'm just going to do PERC, perceived voids create present pursued values. Are y'all tracking? Past perceived voids create present pursued values. What does that mean? That means if I feel like something was missing in the past, I will work in the present to fill the void that I had in the past, right? So that's why if people grow up in a place where they're in like dire hunger conditions or feast or famine, they value food like at a very high level, right? That's why people who, so for me, like I like cars. I like them. I like cars. I grew up working on cars, right? But I grew up in a family where when I was growing up, my parents never bought a new car ever. They had 7 boys. Here's what boys do. They eat you out of house and home, right? Boys can just, it's like they're a bottomless food pit, right? And I can remember, like, if I was in elementary school, if I was going to eat a sandwich, I wouldn't eat a sandwich. I'd eat 2, 3, or 4 sandwiches, right? So, but I like cars. And so we grew up with buying $50 cars, $100 cars, and then working on them and driving them until they broke down. Then we go buy another $50 car, $100 car, and we had no car payments, right? So I like cars. I used to see people with nice cars. I'm like, why do they have nice cars? We don't have nice cars, right? So that's a past perceived void in my life, right? So it became a present pursued value. Some people are like, why do you have all these expensive cars? Well, expensive is a relative term anyway. I don't even, like, that's really relative, like, it depends on like what is expensive to you, right? So, but the reason I like have a collection of, I say a collection, I've got some very nice cars is because I like cars, because that was for me a past perceived void. I work out. Why do I work out? Because in the past I've been out of shape, and in the past my body hurt. The more out of shape I was, the more my body hurt. So that's a past perceived void that created a present pursued value. Are y'all tracking? And so a lot of times we don't even know where these things that we value came from, right? I value entrepreneurship. Why? Because in the past I used to have jobs, and they always came with a boss. And I don't know. The word boss means like they're going to be bossing me around. That's what, like, they're going to tell me, like, can I go? No. And I can't even finish the question, right? Can I have? No. And I don't like to have to ask for permission. I don't like permission. In fact, the best way to get me to do something is to tell me I can't do it. I'm that dude, okay? I know none of you entrepreneurs are that way, right? So you started business because you love people telling you what to do. Okay. Judgment-free zone. And so I like autonomy. My parents, great parents, They weren't perfect parents by any stretch of imagination, which is why I did not become a perfect parent. Okay, so but they were great parents for me and my brothers, right? And they were very authoritarian. Like it didn't matter if I was 7 or 17, why, the answer was always going to be the same. Because I said so, right? So I liked autonomy. So when I wasn't at home, I didn't like teachers telling me what to do at school. I didn't like my parents telling me what to do at home. See, and then I got a job, and the boss wanted to tell me, and everybody wanted to tell me what to do. And I know it's my own little weirdness going on in my mind palace, but like you got yours, I got mine, and I don't like people telling me what to do. So I want to live as autonomous. Now, I want God to tell me what to do, but I don't like humans bossing me around, okay? Because their motive is suspect. God's motive is not suspect, right? Right? And that's why I don't like it when people on my team call me, oh, this is my boss. I'm not your boss. I don't even like the word boss. I don't have an outfit that matches a boss. You don't have an outfit that matches a boss. So unless we're talking about business optimization success secrets from Boss Moves, then again, that's a different story. But not bossing people around. Anyway, so y'all get it. Past perceived voids create present pursued values. But also, the second place values come from is present pursued. I don't think I spelled that right. Pursued victories create present pursued values. So present pursued victories, the things I'm working towards winning right now, will cause me to value that thing, and so I've got a value. I want to win. So because I want to win, okay, for instance, I'm going to put my son-in-law on blast. So my son-in-law, I mean, we're really, really close until we get on the golf course, and then we try to beat each other's brains out. It's great. Okay? So he wants to beat me really, really bad. I want to beat him really, really bad. And for a while, I just beat him all the time. And then, like, I lost my mojo, and then he beat me all the time, and he was sending his mom text messages like, there's a new sheriff in town, and then his mom would call me, and I'm like, is this really happening? Okay, cool. So I started working on my short game again, and so now it's like the last three tournaments we've had, we play three-round tournaments, and we have this trophy, and every time you win three rounds, you get to put your name on the trophy. No, it's not on the news, it's not on ESPN, nobody knows but us, but we relish this victory so much, right? And so what we do, because we both want to win, is we both spend time working on our game, because present pursued victories create present values. So the things that we felt like we're missing in the past, that creates value for us. The things that we're working on winning in the present, and then the last one, is future pursued, I think I spelled that right, I don't know, pursued visions create present perceived values. So what does that mean? That means I can see an outcome down the road that is worth sacrificing right now for, so I'll sacrifice the short term on the altar of the long term. I'll sacrifice like my pleasure right now because I've got this vision down the road, and I'll take some time off of playing golf, and I'll take some time off of practicing my guitar. I'll take some time off from something I want to do for me. Like, okay, give you for instance, I am a foodie. If I wanted to, I could easily weigh 400, 500, 600 pounds. It would be easy. Like, I like food. You say, what kind of food? Almost all kinds. I mean, I don't like pork, and I don't like shrimp, and I don't like yucky stuff. It's disgusting. But I like to eat. And the better it is, the more of it I like to eat. I'm just keeping it real. Like, brother man can throw it down. I can fling it down. Hear me when I tell you. I mean, where are my foodies? Where are my foodies? Okay? But because I have this future vision, right? Like, I've got this future vision. I've got a granddaughter. She's 3. One of the highlights of my life, my entire existence on this planet as a human, was when I got to dance with my daughter at her wedding. That was a highlight for me. Okay? So, one of my future visions that I have is to dance with my granddaughter, not at her wedding. My 3-year-old granddaughter. She's not going to get married at 3. That's not what I mean. Like, my granddaughter who is 3, when she becomes an adult, one of my objectives is to dance with her at her wedding. Well, let's say she gets married when she's 21, like my daughter did. Okay? She'll be 4 in July. So that gives me 17 more years. Well, in 17 years, I'll be 79, right? You know what that tells me? That tells me as much as I love food, and I do love it, I don't like it, y'all. Hear me when I tell you. If I'm going to eat something, I want it to taste. I don't even want to waste any time eating food that don't taste good. Okay, y'all tracking? Like, I'm the guy who, when I make spaghetti, I season the water I boil my noodles in. I'm that dude. Okay, how many of y'all tracking? Okay, now y'all know who y'all dealing with. Okay, so, just keeping it real. Okay, but because I want to dance with my granddaughter at her wedding, when she gets married, I don't eat food until 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And I drink water in the morning, and I have a window to eat between 1 p.m. and 9 p.m. It opens at 1 with a protein shake, then I'll eat some snacks in between, like some carrot chips or some celery or something good with some different whatever dip I decide. I'll mix some honey mustard and some ranch, and I know that's not healthy. I don't really care. This is my vision, y'all. You do you. I'm going to do me. Okay, I know that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but it's what I do right now. So if y'all want me to do better, pray for me. Okay, so. And then I'll eat dinner. So but I'm going to make sure my protein shake is really, really good. And I'm going to make sure my snacks are really, really good. And I'm going to make sure when I eat dinner, look at him, is really, really good. Okay, so what am I telling you? I'm telling you my value comes from something that I desire that's way in the future, that I'm willing to sacrifice right now on, right? It's too many people, they don't understand that today is yesterday's tomorrow. And they act as if the actions they take today have no consequences in the future, right? And so the definition of sacrifice is to let go of something of a lower nature so you can take a hold of something of a higher nature. And the best way for us to live our lives, it's like it's been proven, it doesn't matter whether it's in finances, whether it's in health, whether it's in relationships, it doesn't matter what arena we're talking about, sacrificing the short term on the altar of the long term always ends better than sacrificing the long term on the altar of the short term. It always does. It's just like a principle of life. Okay, so now I know when I'm looking at my particular marketplace in whatever particular niche I'm looking at, then I know what I have to do if I want to create wealth is I have to figure out how to help somebody fill their past perceived voids or how to win their present pursued victories or how to fulfill their future pursued visions. How many of y'all tracking? Okay? So now when I'm looking at somebody, I know what kind of value, how to discover what you value. Because you're going to value one of those three things. Whatever you're working on in your life is probably going to fit into one of those three categories. Now, wealth is the result of value creation. The better your ability to create value for someone other than yourself, the wealthier you are. And sometimes that'll show up as money. Sometimes it'll show up as real estate. Sometimes it'll show up as like hard assets like gold and silver. Or it'll show up as digital assets like Bitcoin and Ethereum. But at the end of the day, whatever you pay for with money that you earned by creating value for someone other than yourself. So the very act of entrepreneurship, by its very nature, has to be self-sacrificing if you're going to win as an entrepreneur. How many of y'all got it? Wave at me. Say, I got it. Wave at me. Okay, good. Cool. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at what God set up in Genesis chapter 1, and I call it the four levels of value. So because here's one of the things I think we don't understand sometimes. All value is not created equally, right? What does that mean? All value is not created equally. So I can say, well, but I created this value. Yeah, but the problem is either you valued it or maybe one other person valued it. You wonder why. like, if you're not doing well financially, I'm going to tell you why. Because the pool of people that you've decided to create value for is very small. Or the thing that you, the value that you've created for them, they value it at a very low level. Like, it's not like a big deal, right? I'm going to pay more for a car than I am for a pair of shoes. Why? That's a bigger value. Why? It can take me farther faster than a pair of shoes, right? So watch this. So, like, even if I go to eat at Ocean Prime or I go to eat at Eddie V's and it costs $500 for dinner for, like, seven people or whatever, I value that more than I value the money, number one. But I also value it because it gives me the time that I want to spend or invest into the people that I care about the most, and I don't have to, like, I don't have to make the food. My wife doesn't have to make the food. My daughter doesn't have to make the food. My son-in-law, we can just sit down. We can go to dinner. We can pay somebody. They make all the stuff. Like, we don't have to go in the kitchen and do anything. We don't even have to open the refrigerator. It's amazing. They just keep bringing it to you. And then you don't have to clean off the table. I mean, if you don't want to, you don't even have to put your own pepper on your food. They'll put the pepper on for you. This is amazing. And then when you get done, you don't have to clean the table up. You don't have to wash any dishes. You just leave. What? Sign me up right now. How many y'all checking? Like, so we have to get to the place in our lives where we realize that all value is not created equally, right? So while I'm giving you things that are not created equally, let me give you something that is created equally. Because all value is not created equally, all no's are created equally, but all yeses are not. What do I mean all no's are created equally? If you do a presentation to a potential client who does not have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no, it feels the exact same as if you do a presentation to somebody who does have the wherewithal to buy your offer, and they say no. A no is 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 a no. Does that make sense? Okay. But if you talk to somebody who does not have the ability to take advantage of your offer, and you make an offer to that person, and they say yes, that's very different than when you talk to a person who has the desire to take advantage of your offer, and they say yes. They have the ability. One has the ability, one doesn't have the ability. Those are two very different yeses. All no's are created equally. All yeses are not. Why would you invest time talking to people who have neither the desire nor the willingness to buy your offer? That's why I don't do high-pressure sales. I'm just not interested in it. I don't need your money. I don't want your money. And if I got to drag you in, I'm going to have to drag you around. Like we would all do better if we would just realize there are already thousands, potentially tens of thousands, potentially hundreds of thousands of people, maybe even millions of people in the world who would love to purchase the value that we create if they only knew we existed. And if that were really the case, then I would be better off to spend my time to make myself findable than I am trying to find somebody to sell something to. Is what I'm saying making sense? Okay, so all value is not created equally. In Genesis chapter 1 and 2, God gave us the four levels of value. The lowest level of value is implementation. Implementation, oh, by the way, let me say this. Wealth is, it's like the value we create for other people, but here's what you have to understand about wealth. Wealth is a spiritual result. What do I mean wealth is a spiritual result? Well, let me ask you a question. Is it more spiritual for you to think about you or for you to think about someone else? Which one? Someone else. It's more spiritual for you to think about solving the problems of someone other than you. Okay? So wealth is a spiritual result. By the way, wealth is also a spiritual result because creativity is spiritual, right? And so if you're going to create value for somebody, that's also spiritual. So watch this. So the lowest level of value is implementation. What do I mean? This is like if you're on this level of value, if you're creating value for other people at the implementation level, you have limited. Who's limited? Everybody tap yourself on the chest, say I have. You've limited your ability to earn. Why? Because you're only going to make somewhere between minimum wage and about $80,000 a year. Well, That sounds kind of painful. Why? Because you're using muscles, which are a physical resource, over time, which is a limited resource. So you're literally using a physical resource over a limited resource to produce an unlimited spiritual result. No wonder you're stuck. This is why I tell people. Now, if you just love like mowing grass and you want to start a lawn care company, that's fine. You just love pressure washing, you want to start a pressure washing business, that's fine. You can make money and create a level of wealth, but a limited level of wealth with a pressure washing business. You can. Or a landscape business or a janitorial service. But here's the problem. You're anchoring your income generation to time and physical labor. That is always going to pay you at the lowest possible level. Why? Because muscles are a physical resource. Time is a limited resource. Wealth is an unlimited spiritual result. Okay, what's the next level? The next level is unification. Unification on this level, you're going to make somewhere between $40,000 a year and maybe if you're like at a Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, you might make $250,000 a year. Well, that, how many of y'all know $40,000 to $250,000 is better than minimum wage to $80,000, right? That's a better window. But, I mean, do you really, and maybe you do, but do you really want a whole year to go by and you only make $250,000? I mean, that's a question we have to answer for ourselves. And for some people, the answer is like, man, if I had a year went by, I made $250,000, that's more than $20,000 a month. Sign me up right now. Okay, great. Sign you up right now, but probably not sign you up forever, right? Can I get a witness, right? Like, it's not a bad place to start, but it's not where we want to land, okay? What is this? This unification on this level, the resource we use on this level is our management skills. Managing people is a higher spiritual activity than doing the thing yourself. Are y'all tracking? That's why when people get into management, they make more. This person over here, they're making tacos at Taco Bell. They're making minimum wage. This person might be a mechanic working at a Rolls-Royce dealership or maybe a Mercedes dealership or BMW dealership. This person right here is managing Taco Bell. This person right here is a middle manager at Lockheed Martin. But the reality is if some company is paying you $250,000 a year, they want you to know they own you. Am I telling the truth? They want you to know. They don't just want you to know they own you. They want you to know they know it. Right? And so like, if that's what you desire, that's fine. But maybe there's a way to have a level of freedom beyond that. And I believe that wealth begins to be created above this line. Wealth begins on the level of communication. Communication, on the level of communication. Now, somebody said the quality of your life will be equal to the quality of your communication. Okay, so communication, the resource you use on this level is your mouth. Now, there's a caveat. You have to have a mouth. You have to be willing to learn to use it. To do what? Create messages that move the masses. It's amazing that this, all of this, is harder than this. But to become a person who's skilled at this is harder than just doing this. What do I mean? Some people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they don't have to develop a level of verbal diligence and verbal intelligence and verbal acuity, right? I don't want to have to learn how to talk, so I'm just going to go ahead and keep on working my fingers to the bone. Well, that's one way to do it, right? Okay. Well, so communication on this level, low end. You should make at least $100,000 a year. If you can sell cars, you can make $100,000 a year selling cars, selling insurance, right? Selling advertising. $100,000 a year. But on the high end, you might make $100 million. Why? Because you're using your mouth to deliver value. Well, Myron, what do you mean $100,000? Like, you know who these people are? These people are salespeople, right? They're also authors. They write books. Our books probably make us $400,000 a year. Just books. I wrote them once. You get paid for them every day. What is it? It's a message communicated. It's like these words that came to my mind, and they actually came out of my mouth. Like I communicated a message that makes me hundreds of... I communicated messages. One of the books I wrote in 2006. This is 2023. That's 17 years. This book has been making me money for 17 years. We sold over 155, 160,000 copies of this one book. Now, who could write a book? Anybody could. Who will write a book? Almost no one. Okay, so, or you might, or these people are coaches and teachers and actors and songwriters and playwrights, right? Please don't let me forget this one. And YouTubers. It's crazy town. YouTube. Don't even get me started on YouTube, y'all. I might not be able to get off of it. Like YouTube? I had no idea. I've been on YouTube since 2007. I didn't even know there was a thing called turning on monetization until 2022. How many years is that? 15. I think it's 15. Ain't that 15? 15 years. I was on YouTube for 15 years. I didn't know all I had to do was click a button. They start paying me. Click a button. Like, this is how long it takes to click a button. Click. Get paid. I mean, I wasn't creating new videos. I had like 40 videos on. We turned on monetization. Did no new videos. The first month, didn't do any new videos. Hadn't done any new videos in like 8 months. Turned on monetization, and we got paid $305. And Zach's like, we made $305 last month. And I said, for what? Because somewhere along the line, I communicated a message somebody wanted to see, and Google or YouTube was able to sell an ad on that. We're talking about 200. This is amazing. I looked at it yesterday. I didn't know this was going to happen, so I didn't do it for this reason. Are y'all tracking? What I'm about to tell you, I did not do for the reason I'm about to tell you what happened, okay? So we started doing YouTube videos intentionally April 1st last year. I looked at it yesterday. In the last 365 days, as of yesterday, we made $289,000 that YouTube paid us. I didn't know they were going to do that. No, you don't understand. I had no idea they were going to do that. Like, that wasn't why I did it. I mean, it was a nice side benefit, right? I've never had a job where I made $280,000 in my life. Most I've ever made at a job is $30,000, ever, as a full-grown man with a family. And YouTube paid me $289,000 for turning on a camera and running my mouth. Where the camera? Turn on the camera. I got something to say. The highest level of value is imagination. It still blows my mind. The resource you use at this level is your mind and your money to make money, to create value for other people. And what happens is at this level, on the low end, you're going to make $1 million. On the high end, it could be billions. And I know that sounds crazy. There's one YouTuber. This dude has 150 million subscribers. He gets over 100 million views a month. 100 million views. If he only makes $2 a view, that's 200 million a month. Are y'all tracking? It's just the whole world that we live in is kind of insanical. It's kind of the combination of insane and maniacal put together. We can fight to stay down here, and people will do it too, because everything you do down here is hard. But I don't know if anything's harder than this. than thinking. Thinking is the hardest work most people never do. In fact, I believe that most people will maintain a state of physical diligence so they can maintain a state of mental laziness. They will work hard at what's not working so they don't have to think about what would work. Most people will work hard at what's not working so they won't have to think about what would work. They will maintain a state of physical diligence, like working their fingers to the bone, sweat, blood, tears, so they don't have to think about what would work. So they can maintain a state of mental laziness. Most people are so mentally lazy, it's pathetic. Now, I know what some of you are thinking. Myron, I don't know the Bible you've been reading. I did not see that in chapter 1. Okay, I'm going to read it to you. It's kind of mind-blowing. So, a couple things. One is that Genesis chapter 1, I believe, if all God wanted us to know from Genesis chapter 1 was that he created everything, Genesis chapter 1 could have been Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Then he starts going into all this detail. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, let there be light. And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good. Like, what is all that about? Well, the first thing God tells about God is not that he is love, even though he's love. It's not that he's holy, even though he's holy. The first thing that God tells about God is not that he's omniscient or omnipresent or omnipotent, even though he is all those things. The first thing God tells about God is that he's creative. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. What's the first thing God tells about us? The first thing he tells about us is that he created us in his image, which means he created us to create stuff and he made us to make stuff. What does that mean? What that means is when God created everything, after he created everything, Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. After he did it, then he went back and documented the process so when we got ready to create value for someone else, we'd have a pattern. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. That was his intention. And the earth was without form. That word was not, used to be, it became, without form and void. So disruption always follows intention. And darkness upon the face of the deep. So when disruption comes, it comes in the form of devoidness, deformity, and darkness. Like things get broken. There's confusion. Darkness is a picture of confusion and fear and anxiety. And then the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the water. So you have this intention, and then disruption follows your intention. So now you've got to find a source of inspiration. The Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. God said, let there be light. That's illumination. You've got to learn something you didn't know so you can see something you couldn't see. You see what happens when we see God's not just, he's not just, well, I just happen to do this. No. He's showing us what to do. And then he took time to see what he had created, and then he recognized that it was good. See, some of us, like, we'll go do all this really great stuff, and then we won't even take time to enjoy what we've created. You're not even being like God. Okay, y'all tracking. So it gets more better. So here it is, Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to show y'all where I got this from. Genesis chapter numero uno. Here we go. Here's what it says. When God created man, I'm going to just go down to that part. Here's what it says. Verse 26. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that moveth upon the earth. So God created man in his own image, and in the image of God created him, male and female created he them. So, and God blessed them and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply, replenish the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the air, and over every living thing that moveth upon the earth. Okay, so here's the first thing we see. And God said, it's really interesting. So if you go back and read Genesis chapter 1, what you'll see it says, and God said, like at Genesis 1, I think it's verse 3, and God said, let there be light. Maybe it's verse 4. And God said, let there be light, right? Okay, when God created creation, he said, let there be. Let there be light. Let there be a firmament that separates the waters from the waters. So when God created creation, there's three categories. There's creation, there's creatures, and there's creators. When God created creation, he said, let there be. When God created creatures, he said, let the earth bring forth and let the waters bring forth. Let the earth bring forth the cattle and the creeping things. Let the water bring forth the fish and the fowl. What is God doing? He's delegating some of the work that he did to something that he's already created. So we could call that delegation. We could call that automation. right? Are y'all tracking? So that you're not doing everything. Okay, so y'all tracking. Okay, now, but when he created man, he didn't say, let there be man. That shows us that man is not a higher form of animal. He didn't say, let the earth bring forth man. He didn't say, let the waters bring forth man. So we know that man is very, very different than creation, and he's very, very different than creatures. How do we know that? Because what God said when he created them was different. When he created creation, he said, let there be. When he created creatures, he said, let the waters bring forth, let the earth bring forth. When he created man, here's what he said, let us. Let us make man in our image. Oh, what's he saying? I'm about to do something different, y'all, than everything I've already done. I saved the best for last. It's about to be on, y'all. Okay, now, God said, let us make man in our image. You know what that means? Before God could say, let us make man in our image, the image had to exist first. That's why imagination is the highest level, because it represents God. It's the God realm. God said, oh, there's the communication. By the way, could God have made man in his image without saying it? Yes, he could have. But he said it. Why? Because that's part of our creative power, is to create messages that move us and messages that move others. Here's what the scripture says. A man shall eat good by the fruit of his mouth. Death and life are in the power of the tongue, and they that love it shall eat the fruit thereof. Thou shalt also declare a thing, and it shall be established where? Unto thee. I'm not talking about speaking things into existence. You can't do that. I can't do that. Only God could do that. That's a bara. The only person in scripture who baras is God. But what I can do is I can talk to myself like David did when he did what? Encourage himself in the Lord. How do you encourage yourself in the Lord? Say the same thing to yourself that God said to you about you. When I speak God's word to me, guess what I'm doing? I am installing faith into a space where doubt used to exist. So I can take an action in faith that I could not take in doubt. How many of y'all track it? Why? How do I know that? Because faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by what? The word of God. So the best thing I can do for me is to say the same thing about me that God says about me. Because when I see myself like he sees me, now I can do what he says I can do and not what other people say I can't do. Are y'all tracking? And this is where I got the four levels of value, right? So when we're working at those highest levels, we're working that imagination realm. Then we start communicating, we're working that communication realm. But God didn't say, let me make man in my image. What did he say? Let us make man in our image. That's the unification part. Two are better than one, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Are y'all, this is so powerful for, the money is nothing more than proof that you've created the value. The wealth is the value that you create for someone other than yourself. And if you create enough value for enough other people, there's nothing in this world that you desire that you can't have. Now, and maybe that's not even what you want. There's nothing in this world that I desire that I don't already have. Somebody commented on one of my videos, somebody commented on one of my videos, they said, but you can't take it with you. And I can't take the lot I got with me. You can't take the little you got with you. We ain't taking none of it with us. That's first. But I said, I have neither the desire nor the inclination to take any of it with me. I'm not working to take it with me. I'm working so that I can keep contributing to the charities and the ministries that I contribute to, and so that I can leave the rest to my children, my children's children. I have no intention of taking it with me. I can send some ahead, and I can leave the rest here. I have no desire to take any with me. Myron, how much money do you want to make? As much as I can. How much wealth do you want to create? As much as I can. But wealth is not the money. Wealth is the value that I create for someone other than me. Okay, I gotta finish. The last thing it says, Genesis chapter 2, because I didn't realize. Larry didn't tell me that I was getting ready to go overtime, but that's okay. It's okay. Now I know who I'm dealing with. Okay. Larry's my dude. Okay, so Here's what it says, Genesis chapter 2, verse 7, "And the Lord God formed man of the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and the man became a living soul." I'm going to finish with this. God formed. What is that? That's the implementation. The last thing God did was made the physical part of man. Then what did he do? He breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. The man that he made in his imagination with his communication, patterned after his unification, he breathed that man into the body that he formed. And the man became a living soul. That's why I call these the four levels of value. Now y'all know where I got it from in Genesis chapter 1. By the way, it's confirmed in Genesis chapter 11. The people in Babel were trying to build a tower whose top could reach heaven. Do you know how ridiculous that sounds in a day where they don't have hydraulics, they don't have helicopters, they don't have cranes? But here's what it says. The Lord God came down to see the tower and the sun, the city and the tower which the sons of men builded. And he said, this people is one, that's unification. They all have one language, that's communication, and one speech. Now this they begin to do, that's implementation. Now nothing will be restrained from them, which they've imagined to do. They are the four levels of value. If you apply these four levels, even working on something that's not good, it will still work. That's how powerful it is, because it's a principle, and principles are God's automation. So let's make sure we apply the four levels of value to something good and not to something evil. I hope that blesses you. Thank you for subscribing. By the way, next Friday, which is the 9th, I think, of June, I am going to be doing a giveaway for subscribers. So you want to subscribe to my YouTube channel. If you haven't already, you want to subscribe to the channel, because we're going to be picking some subscribers. You want to subscribe publicly so people know, so we can pick from the people who subscribe. And we're going to pick somebody, and we're going to be doing a giveaway. I'm not going to tell you what the giveaway is right now, but I'll tell you on the Bible study here that's coming up in a few minutes. All right, bye for now.
What's up, guys? This is Alex Martin, and this is the Content Creator Podcast, where I stimulate your mind and show you how to market your grind. And today, we're going to stimulate your mind. I got the legend, the icon, Freeway Rick Ross. How you doing today, bro?
I'm good. How you?
I'm good, bro. Can't complain.
No doubt. No doubt.
I can't lie, man. Right now, I'm like, I got the jitters, you know.
Because I see you geeked.
Yeah, I'm excited. And first, I want to say thank you. Like, you didn't have to come here, and yet you did it, man. So I appreciate it.
Oh, come on, man. This is how I do. You know, everybody's important.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's movement is important. Even if it's not important to me, it's important to them. And if I don't respect your movement, you shouldn't respect mine. So.
You're big on.
Hey there, everyone. My name is Jordan from Happen Films, and this is a $420 tiny house. Let's check it out.
This beautiful structure behind us is the house that we built over the course of about 3 months out of pretty much entirely recycled materials. So the total cost of the house is about $420 if you include the petrol money that went into it.
And the size is about 2.5 by 2.5 meters, 6.25 square.
We went by dumpsters from demolition sites. We looked on the website Gumtree. We ended up getting pretty much everything we needed to build a whole house just for free.
So we decided to try and build our home with just hand tools.
Yeah, we tried to. We didn't manage to in the end. There were a couple of things that were too difficult for us to do with the tools that we had and the skills that we had.
So we ended up having to use a power drill and an impact driver.
We had to make 5 purchases. We bought some cement for the foundations, some steel bracing tape because it was a bit wonky, some screws for the roof, a little tub of wood glue to make some window frames. We bought chains to hold the windows open. Oh, we bought the 6 things. We bought some hinges.
So we were using salvaged paper insulation to try and line the whole house, and we ran out. We were just short and we didn't have enough to do the roof. But luckily we found this stuff in a dumpster. We were out a couple of months ago going through the local supermarket dumpsters looking for food, and there was this perfectly new tarp in brand new condition, and it's still in its packet.
I guess we wanted to challenge the idea that you need like a whole lot of high-tech tools and skills and knowledge to be able to build a house. I mean, that house is mostly built with a handsaw and a hammer. I think the main challenge we face is that neither of us have ever really built anything before. Rachel built a chick coop. I built a set of bunk beds once. We had to learn everything as we went. It takes it away a little bit from that professional need a whole lot of tools, need a whole lot of skills, and a whole lot of different people. You need someone to lay the foundation, someone to build a frame, someone to paint it. The conventional building methods that are used, it's hard to imagine them being sustained more than 50 or 100 years in the future. Just the amount of resources that they require and the importation of all kinds of things. We acknowledge that this kind of building can't really be sustained either. It's not an indefinitely sustainable technique. But using recycled materials and building much smaller spaces is something that can be sustained for a lot longer into the future. We live on a community, which means there are communal spaces for socialising. We have a communal bathroom, shower. For us, a house is really just a place to be able to have some quiet time in, a place to sleep in, a place to store our personal belongings in. Living a more of a shared communal lifestyle means that we can get away with just a really small house because we don't really need it for all these other things. It's great to have built our own house. It's like more than just having built a house. The house is cool. Yeah, don't get me wrong, it's great. But to have developed the skills and knowledge to do it again and to like share that with other people, I'm just, yeah, chuffed about the amount that I've learned through doing that.
Land ownership can be a huge barrier for people looking to live this way. And some people who see this may think that it isn't possible for them because they can't afford to buy their own land. The community that Liam, Rachel, me, and four others live on is owned by one family, and they allow us to stay on the land rent-free in exchange for developing the property by building infrastructure, planting veggie gardens, and taking care of the place. I feel that more scenarios like this will start to happen, where owners of unused land invite people to live on their property to develop a community and to do something great with the land. The challenge is connecting land owners with people looking to live this way.
Even if you've got no skills and knowledge, you can kind of just do that yourself. And it's much easier, it's much more affordable as well for people like us. We don't have a great deal of money. It's much more accessible. I could just kind of build a much smaller space and then share your other spaces with other people.
I got in a huge tax situation in 2008 because my divorce was in 2005 and my accountant had gotten in cahoots, and next thing you know, my accountant died and a girl that worked for him called my lawyer and said, "We have a problem." She had found on the floor all my tax forms for 7 years signed and with the checks stapled to them. So I'm thinking, I've signed and I've stapled the checks. Well, they were cashing the checks, keeping the money, and not turning in the tax form. They took the money out of the account that matched the exact, because I wasn't watching it.
So
like
you could just see $100,000, $600,000
deducted.
It. Yeah.
So I'm thinking it's the check. Little did I know, it was some people taking the money out.
For 7 years?
For 7 years.
How much money did that?
I ended up owing $22
million. Wow.
$22 million with the penalties. So now, wow. Listen to me, man. Me and my wife in 2008, I get the call. And the way I found out was, my lawyer called me and said, "Hey, man, we got a problem. You haven't paid taxes in 7 years. I said, "Man, what are you talking about? I paid taxes. I've been writing the checks and all this here." Oh, man.
By the time you met Blondon, how big were you getting? Like, how much were you buying on a regular basis?
Oh, no, maybe a couple pounds, 16 pounds maybe.
16 pounds.
Yeah, 8 pounds, something like that. At that time, pounds were going for 35,000 a pound, yeah.
By the time you met Blondon, how much cash did you have?
I don't know. I had a few hundred thousand.
A few hundred thousand. So you weren't a millionaire back then, but you were well off.
I was doing good.
You were doing good.
I was doing pretty good.
So how did the whole Blondon thing come together?
Well, see, we were still getting from the Blondon, but we wasn't going directly to Blondon.
It was a middleman.
It was a middleman. So. The only thing happened when we met him personally was that the middleman had got cut out, which dropped the price even more. But we were already getting it from Blondon, technically.
Technically.
Yeah.
You just weren't talking to him.
I just wasn't talking to him.
Okay. So how did you end up meeting him?
I bought him.
You bought him?
Mm-hmm.
So you basically bought your connect.
Yeah.
So you told your middleman, "I'm going to give you...
$60,000.
$60,000, and you introduce me to your connect, and you can walk away with that $60,000.
Yep, and then Blandon paid $60,000 as well.
To meet you.
Yeah, to meet me.
So the connect got $120,000 to essentially walk away from that part of the business?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he got spooked, I heard. You know, somebody had got busted.
He was trying to get out of the game.
So he felt, you know, he'd take $160,000, go back to Honduras, and live like a king.
$120,000. And that's what he did? He left?
I guess, yeah, for a while.
Okay. So now you're working with the Connect. Blandon.
Yep.
How is that relationship different than your previous relationship?
We got a lot tighter, you know. Me and Blandon hung out a little bit together. You know, I would go over his house. The other guys were more meet on the street, switch cash for money, you know, money for drugs, and it's over. But me and Blandon, we kind of hung out. We talked about business. So we developed kind of what I thought was a friendship as well.
Okay. Now, Blandon is the one that actually took you to the next level.
Technically, yeah, and no, you know.
Explain.
I mean, we took each other to the next level.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
You know, I wasn't, I wasn't out here helpless and homeless. You know, when I met him, I had a few $100,000, and I had clientele. I knew the streets. You know, I knew all the shot callers from every hood in L.A. You know. So he helped, but, you know, not by itself.
According to some articles that I looked up, and you could tell me whether this is accurate or not, it said that you were making up to $3 million a day.
I've had days that I made $3 million.
You had a $3 million day?
Yeah.
Okay.
A few of them.
A few of them. Explain how you have a $3 million day.
Well, your big customers come through. Couple of them, and they drop off $200,000, $300,000. There were three or four spots that I had in L.A. where guys just stood out on the street that would make $100,000 a day, each one.
Each one?
Yeah.
Now, this actually built up. I guess you had operations in 42 cities?
I don't know how many cities. I mean...
A lot of cities.
We had a lot of cities.
All throughout the country.
Yeah.
So explain to me, and okay.
You know, different people do their estimates and their calculations and all
right.
that stuff. So,
and I guess the other thing is that you moved $900 million worth of cocaine.
Or more.
Or more, which in today's dollars is the equivalent of $2.5 billion.
Yeah.
So you were moving.
You figure like this here. If you do 100 kilos... In one day, that cocaine goes a lot of places. You know, a lot of people, they taking it, they putting it on airplanes, they moving it around. Now you're talking about you move 200 kilos in one day, or 250, you're talking about that's a lot of cocaine.
Okay. If you were to stack up 250 kilos right now, how big would it be? Would it cover this entire room?
No. 250 kilos is not that big. Maybe the size of that couch.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that's the equivalent of $3 million?
According to what price you're getting.
Yeah.
What time it is. You know, one time I paid as much as $48,000 for a kilo. So $3 million won't go for it when you're buying them like that.
Right.
But if you're getting them for 10 a kilo, you can buy 300.
Okay.
So all that factors in, you know. And I, like I said, I paid as much as, I paid 3,300 for an ounce of cocaine. And if you add that up, you're talking about like $100,000 for 1 kilo. But for the whole kilo, I paid $48,000 cash for one. And I've also bought them for 9.5.
Right.
As low as 9.5.
So How were you actually getting this much cocaine on a regular basis? Were you getting it once a week, every day?
100 keys every day.
You were getting 100 kilos years. Every day?
My last 2 years, yeah, every day.
Every single day?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you say how you were actually getting it?
In the trunk of cars.
So Blandon would basically set
up... He'd have
up.
A driver to pull up wherever I wanted it dropped off, and they'd pull it there and leave the keys under the floor mat. My guys would get in it and take it to where I wanted it.
Okay. How big was your actual crew in terms of people that answer directly to you? Obviously, when you're talking about hundreds of kilos, it's going all over the world, and there's all types of people.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. Like, if you see the special they did on CBS called LA Gang Godfathers, I think they had me surrounded by about 25 guys,
okay,
30 guys who were like my, they call lieutenants.
Okay.
But it varied from time to time, you know. Guys quit, get fired, you know.
Get busted.
Get busted, which was rare.
Why was it rare?
I taught my guys how to sell and how to avoid the law.
Okay.
So they were pretty good at avoiding the law.
How did you really manage a crew like this? Because when you talk about money, this much money, you're talking about drugs, you're talking about women, you're talking about violence, you're talking about gangs. And then you're also talking about law enforcement. How do you really manage a crew of this many people and keep it from just falling apart in an afternoon, which happens all the time?
The first thing you got to do, you have to really be humble in yourself and always look at situations from the other person's point of view. That's one of the things that I do. I always try to see your point of view first, because I know to you, the most important thing is your point of view. You don't care about my point of view, but your point of view is always important. So I usually go with your point of view, and most of the time is, how can I get food, shelter, and clothes?
Okay.
Those are motivating, really, really high motivating factors. So if you can provide those to most people, they'll give you their attention. I mean, you're going to run into some, though. That's, you know, you can give them that. And they still going to be, what did we call it earlier? We were talking about it earlier. I forgot what it was. But we were talking about shady or something like that.
Yeah.
Or shiesty or something we called it. Yeah. So no matter what you do, you still can run into those type of people. But, you know, you just be able to roll past it.
Okay. So you had 25 people, roughly. Allegedly,
yeah.
Moving up to $3 million a day in product.
Some days.
On some days.
And there'd be days where there's $2
million. Yeah.
$1.5 million.
Okay.
$1.2 million.
They don't really portray Chicago like that. And he did a lot of funny shit with it, man.
I made $3 million in just 6 months as a 20-year-old female entrepreneur, and you can too. Growing up, I was always in like the advanced classes, in high school I was in the AP, the honors classes, and so even being separated from so many people, even starting at a young age, it definitely made me realize that I'm a little bit different. It was a little bit hard to fit in. I'm black, I'm Hispanic, I'm Muslim. I went through so many different phases of trying to figure out what I wanted to do. I remember there was a point in time where I wanted to be an engineer, I wanted to be an interior designer. My sophomore year, I lived with my dad. That same year, my brother Jamil lived with my dad, and we were always super close. First day I got there, he took me to his room and he showed me the stack of books that he had. And one of them was called How to Win Friends and Influence People. And he's like, you gotta read this book, you gotta start reading, it's really gonna change your mindset, it's really gonna help you be successful. He had this whiteboard on his wall and it said, I will be a millionaire by 22. And in my head, like, I was thinking, like, where did he come up with that? Like, we've never seen a millionaire in our life. Money was never something that we grew up seeing, it was never something that we were familiar with. My family never had a lot of money in any aspect. And I thought that it was amazing that he had such drive.
drive and could picture a goal that seemed so far off, but to him seemed achievable. Junior year, I was living by myself. I had actually moved away from my dad's and I was living with family friends. The same year that I was living by myself, my oldest brother passed away. And when he passed away, my whole perspective on life changed. Everything, like school, the people that I hung around, what was important to me, how I was spending each day, because I really realized that life is so, so, so short. And the fact that my brother was taken at 22, I was only 16 and he was one of the closest people to me. And so I never understood why he was taken so soon. I didn't understand it. I was going through my own grieving process. It changed everything and put life into a different perspective. I really got very selective with what I was putting into my mind, the people that I was hanging around. I got very isolated. I started really just focusing on my art, on working, and really just being alone and focusing on my family. I was asking myself, I didn't see my brother before he passed away because it wasn't winter break yet, because I had to stay in school for winter break. Was school ever that important where I didn't see my brother before he passed away because I had to be at school? You could not even finish school and your life could be over. I have other things that are more important to me, my family, my time, what I want to do with my life. Because we grow up from kindergarten to 12th grade in school, we naturally rely on like who we are as a student as part of our identity. What you start to realize is like all you're doing is giving power to someone else to tell you how valuable you are or to tell you how qualified you are. I didn't need someone else to tell me if I was worth doing a job or not, or if I was good enough to do something, because if I wanted to do something, I just had to decide to do it, and I don't need validation from someone else, whether that be a teacher, whether that be a professor, whether that be an employer, from anyone. You don't actually need validation from someone. You just have to decide within yourself that you're capable of doing it and go for it. Once I got into college and I started going through the day-to-days, I was working two full-time jobs. It was exhausting. I spent a lot of time doing things for other people. It was like I was doing my schoolwork for my teachers, but it didn't really make sense to me. I wasn't really understanding what I was supposed to get out of it. I was nannying to make enough money to survive, but it wasn't enough to do anything beyond that because I had to spend all my time working. One day I was sitting in class and I was listening to my teacher talk, and he gave us this huge assignment, and it was a predominantly white school, so everyone partnered up into these groups, and I was just sitting there by myself, and again I felt like I didn't fit in. I started like just wondering, what am I doing here? These assignments, these aren't helping me progress in the area that I want to progress in. They're kind of just like buffer time. They're just busy assignments to keep us busy. It wasn't really what I needed to achieve the success I wanted. And actually at the same time, I was finishing up first semester of my freshman year of college. I got an interview with this very high profile family for nannying, and I'd never had an experience like that. And even when the experience came up, I kept asking myself, like, why me? Like, why am I getting this opportunity to work for such a high profile family? I'm an 18-year-old who's not even CPR certified. Out of all people, why would they pick me? And my mom kept telling me, like, that's not the right mentality to have. Like, who cares if you're 18 years old? You know that you're an amazing nanny. You know that you're caring, compassionate, that you know how to care for children. You've done that your whole life. And then I started asking myself, would I rather learn from a professor, or would I rather learn from a billionaire who has the lifestyle that I want and I could actually learn from him in person and see his lifestyle? So at the end of freshman year, I remember we were finishing up with classes and I was listening to these tapes, and they said people who are successful make decisions quickly and they stick to those decisions. I decided right then and there, I was like, I'm going to be done with school. I'm going to drop out. And so that same day, I texted my counselor and I said, please unenroll me from all upcoming classes. And she was like, oh no, like, is something wrong? Is there something I can help with? And I was like, no, thank you. Just please unenroll me. I'll no longer be attending Maryville. If I'm not going to go to school, I have to figure out how I'm going to be a successful entrepreneur. I started reading books. I started watching YouTube videos. I was doing cosmetology. I learned how to do nails completely by myself.
Okay. All right. Interesting morning here. All right. Micro communities, which we'll be talking about these a little bit every day, micro communities, these are communities that will be developing, and there's nothing new. Micro communities where if you don't want to have a house note, pay expensive rents or utility bills, that's what we're developing. We already have land in a few places already, so we'll be in a more orderly fashion on that. But it's an intentional community. So tomorrow and for the rest of this week, we'll be talking about intentional communities, specifically we're not going anywhere, we always go over time. What is an intentional community? In our case, our intentional communities, we build, well, the people that will live there or have a housing structure there. Number one, they built them debt-free. Number two, They built them off the grid, so there's no electric bill, there's no water bill, there's no municipal business going on there other than the yearly taxes. Ms. Francis, Solar Home Communities, well, that's the first blanket of stuff that we'll be doing, homes, or communities, rather. We'll have Build Your Own Home Retreat, and, of course, our favorite teaching method, crawl, walk, and run. Okay, now, as I got off track today, 773, you available? Okay, they might have gone. All right, I got off track today, so what we'll do is we're going to pick back up tomorrow, and you guys have a good rest of the day. And we'll be back tomorrow. Have a great day. Oh, wait a minute. Don't go nowhere yet. I got stuff standing up all night. That's what I got to do. Okay. All right. So back tomorrow with more information on, additional information on micro communities where you pay no house payment, no utility bills.
At Jiffy Lube, we car about cars. In fact, we're kind of obsessed. That's why we've been taking care of business with quick quality oil changes and service for over 40 years. And with things like our Carful Vehicle Review, where our experts check, fill, clean, and inspect your vehicle, you'll know we'll car for your car like we car for our own. Jiffy Lube. Car more.
Visit JiffyLubeDC.com to find a Jiffy Lube service center near you.